For the most part, our healthcare system is designed to help people get well, but not all patients can recover. Today, we'll talk about healthcare at the end of life. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, I'll talk with a palliative care doctor and two individuals who work with hospice groups. We'll talk about the difference this kind of care can make and the important choices that families face.
It's a great gift to your children or family members to let them know where they should generally draw the line, because no one wants to, at a critical time, make a decision that is a vote against someone in the eyes of God.
Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. As humans, we encounter many different kinds of injury and illness. When we seek medical care, it's usually with the hope that someone can help us get better. But not all patients will get better. This hour, we're going to talk about end-of-life care. We'll focus on hospice later in the hour, but first, a relatively young field, palliative care. Dr. Tim Thompson is Interim Director of Palliative Care at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. He is a board-certified surgeon in palliative care. In fact, he's only the 31st doctor in the country to be certified in palliative care. Dr. Thompson, thank you so much for being here today.
It's nice to be here. Thank you.
For people who aren't familiar with the term, what is palliative care?
Basically, when people have life-limiting or life-threatening illness, and you've reached the place where you don't have any more technology to throw at them, it would be awfully nice to relieve their suffering, make certain that you restore their dignity as much as you can, and allow them to have the best quality of life they can between that time and when their life ends.
I describe this as a relatively young field with all of the technology that we have available in medicine that we didn't used to have available. And then as technology changed, we had more options available to help patients. Do you feel like this is something we used to do as a culture, where we helped people die in comfort and we lost sight of that with so many medical options for many years?
I think you've hit the nail perfectly. We, as physicians in particular, had a big degree of magic as recently as maybe the late 1800s. Surgery was being done, but we certainly didn't have transplants, penicillin, any number of things, even when I was in medical school. Since the late 1970s, the amount of technology, medication, tricks, tools, medical toys that we have to throw at illness, we have a huge generation of physicians who, I think, have lulled themselves into thinking that death is not going to occur. And so the art of medicine, which my great-grandfather would have practiced in the late 1800s, has kind of disappeared, and palliative care is trying to come in and restore that.
What brought you into this field?
It's certainly not a normal path for a surgeon. I've done a lot of different things in medicine, and periodically through a career of 35-plus years, I would think about the fact that I'd like to be in a position where I could help people make sense out of their complicated care or give them suggestions about that. I've also been on kind of a journey from the standpoint of spirituality, getting back to a place where my spirituality is in a good place. And so it seemed like it was a good fit. I really did not understand what it was about when I went into it. Had no idea.
When does a patient come to you? What are the circumstances that usually leads you to begin engaging with a patient in palliative care?
Sometimes it's driven by patients' families. They've read something about it. They've heard a radio piece about it. So that patient's family might say, wait a minute, my dad is awfully sick and everybody wants to keep doing things to him. And so that's a common way. Sometimes it's specialists who just finally recognize that they've run out of things. And I think maybe the physician is having this feeling in their heart or in their conscience that is kind of saying, wow, I'm not necessarily very good at making the switch to simply caring for the patient's spirit and for their heart, but I know there's people who can do that, and so we're going to ask them to help us.
When you begin working with a patient, How do you start?
I try to establish first what they understand. If you're willing to step up and give the patient a prognosis, then the patient can make accurate decisions about chemotherapy and how they'd like to live their final days or whatever else. So I ask the team, because usually the patient doesn't know. Now, when I go to asking the patient, sometimes they surprise me and say, you know, they haven't told me, but I don't think it's going to be long, doc. So I usually start in trying to feel them out and figure out what's going on for them right at the time.
So often you have to break this news?
I break the news a lot. And I've had to get so that I can say the word die to somebody. It took me my first 2 months to get to where I could get those words out of my mouth, and I did them with a 37-year-old patient who had children and a very serious illness, and it went really, really badly. And I thought, give up that idea. Then I went through a phase where I got comfortable enough in talking about death that I probably said death too much to some patients, you know, wore the families down, and that wasn't intentional. But it doesn't, and I couldn't say the words die to my own parents.
It sounds like it's still a very difficult thing to do, to break that news.
It's by far the hardest work that I ever have done. I've done trauma surgery, been a heart surgeon, you know, hold the human heart in my hand, fix it, stop the heart, start, you know. But what happens is you find yourself in this interface between the most aggressive, scientific, spectacular medicine that exists and death. It's very, very daunting. There's times that I have nightmares about the way it went. And yet, particularly with the dying patient, it is so spectacular to be present with them and to speak to them about their death and how they're doing with that. They teach you so much.
Once they understand what the prognosis is and what remains, what can you offer them? Obviously, you want to minimize pain and make sure they're comfortable. But what kinds of choices can you give them?
Well, we do what's called a goals of care discussion. The patients have been deconstructed for their care by a lot of different specialties, and they've lost a lot of dignity, and they've lost a lot of control, and they don't even feel like they have any say in things. And so if I've established that they have a limited time to live, and I say, okay, if you can accept the fact that we can't cure you, then what are the things that you can accomplish between now and the day that you die a natural death that will give meaning to your life? And then you speak to them about those things. You speak to them about the things about which they're the most proud, the things they'd like you to know most about them. And you try to put their life that they've lived and the time that they have ahead of them into a context where they can find meaning in that.
Can you give me a concrete example of something that a patient has asked of you or told you that they needed to accomplish or wanted to accomplish before their death?
I think one of the most difficult settings is in a patient who is young, who has been treated for cancer aggressively, who wants life, is willing to go through a lot of treatment, probably has, you know, this particular patient had several children. She too is in her late 30s, early 40s. And she was counting on the idea that somebody would flip the switch and say, it's time to quit, because she had a litany of things that she wanted to get done. But as we do when we're young, we're focused on, you know, getting everything into a tight time frame. I'm going to get well, and then I'm going to take care of my kids. Well, abruptly, it was realized that her cancer was out of control. There was no further therapy. She was too sick. And the oncologist didn't really want to have that discussion. And so, you know, I went in to tell her. And it was so devastating to her because, I mean, she literally had days to live. And she hadn't gotten through any of the stuff that she wanted to record for her daughters or things she wanted to do for these young kids who, when they got married, and, you know, things like that. So that's kind of the worst scenario and the biggest justification for truth telling.
When there are a lot of things that they want to do but no time
right
left to do them. Give me a best scenario.
Well, a quick best scenario is a 92-year-old man who, you know, I said, you know, what would you like to do? And of course, all the kids are saying, oh, dad's lived a good life. And he goes, yeah, I couldn't ask for more. I've got all these wonderful children. I said, so nothing that you've ever wanted to do your whole life. And he said, well, I always wanted to see an iceberg. And all his kids are going, what? He said, I've always wanted to see an iceberg. And so ultimately, to keep the story short, they were able to use that as a catalyst for the family and enrolled him in hospice, got everything in place and, headed out on their trip. It gives the family great pleasure to have accomplished this thing for Dad to go see his iceberg.
Wow. And so in a case like that, even if someone was terminal, you might continue treatment so that they could plan for a trip and live through the trip?
In most cases, the treatment is not going to allow them to get the trip. We make that mistake. We think I'm going to get treated, and when I'm all done with this, then I'm going to be able to get life back on track. Particularly when you've exhausted most options, you have to decide, am I willing to accept the fact that I'm going to die, and I'm going to take whatever days to weeks to months that I have, and I'm going to live it richly and fully, on the front end of things. And they get the stuff accomplished based on how much energy reserve they have and how much good fortune.
Is it empowering in some way for them to know that they're dying?
None of us know how we're going to face it when it finally falls on our lap. But the acknowledging of death, particularly in front of the patient's family, is pretty empowering. The patients do the dying well. The families are generally a mess. But if everybody's heard the same information, then they can be natural with each other. They can cry. They can move through it better. In fact, I often see in family discussions that I'll start the conversation with the family members around the bed, sitting up close to the patient who's so ill, talking to the patient and then telling the patient I'm going to talk to their family. Is that all right? And then beginning to speak to the family. And the family will often whisper to me that they're concerned about how candid I'm being because Dad is present. And Dad generally has, closed his eyes and he looks as if he's sound asleep. And initially I wasn't certain, but when I asked the patient, they immediately open their eyes. And if I inquire about how they're doing, they nod their heads or softly acknowledge that this is giving them great peace and it's so nice to have their family informed about what the situation is.
When the family knows, and when they know also that the patient knows, do you sometimes sense just a tremendous sense of relief that this is in the open?
It's not sometimes, it's always, almost without exception. Many physicians feel that if they tell the families the truth, that they're going to take away hope. The majority of the time when we tell them the truth, it sets them free. I had a man who was very, very severely ill, been treated by many, many specialists, who got the news from me that he had a matter of days to weeks to live. And he looked at me and took my hand and he said, thank you so much for telling me the truth. Where were you 15 months ago when I started asking questions and nobody would answer me?
I'm talking with Dr. Tim Thompson. He is interim director of palliative care at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. This hour, we're talking about end-of-life care, and we'll talk about hospice care later in the hour. We'll continue this conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. I'm talking with Dr. Tim Thompson. He is interim director of palliative care at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. This hour, we're talking about end-of-life care, and we'll continue our conversation about hospice in a few minutes. But right now, we are talking about palliative care, which is a relatively young field and an unusual field for a surgeon to be in, Dr. Thompson. Before the break, we were talking about the fact that you find yourself in a position where you are the one that has to break the news often to people who are terminally ill, where you have to tell someone you don't have much time or you have about this much time left. And we talked about some of the things that people can choose to do at that time, the choices that they can make, go on a trip to go see an iceberg, for example. Does this give some families an opportunity for joy again? Instead of the fear and the secrets?
It does, and I think it often surprises the patient. They often will think that my daughter will never manage this. She can't possibly handle it. And when they and they'll ask me to please deliver the news to their family member. And I think the patient is certainly surprised sometimes, and I think it sets the family members free. it's the unutterable truth that you're going to lose someone. And on the flip side, there's also devastation and profound grief associated with the loss of someone that you love.
You personally have gone through the loss of both of your parents, and I know that you were very close and helped them through their deaths in some ways. And you've said that they have had very different deaths. Tell us about your father.
My dad was 45. He had me at a young age. I was graduating from medical school at the time that he told me that he'd found a lump in his testicle and he had cancer of the testicle, same illness that Lance Armstrong had, just to focus people. But my dad happened to have it 3 years before they had curative chemotherapy. So he was diagnosed in May and died in September. At that time, we had some of the early forms of chemotherapy, but all of them were very toxic. And the initial discussion with him was about whether he should take chemotherapy or not. Now, remember, I'm only a senior in medical school. I don't have much experience. And then as he decided to try some chemotherapy, and I continued in kind of the mode as the doctor instead of as the son, which would have been better if I'd been in the son mode. And then I also had the tough decision after he tried a couple courses of chemotherapy of speaking with him about not going on to the more highly toxic forms of chemotherapy that were going to have an equally poor chance of success. I think that was a blessing for me in allowing me to work through that difficult process, and certainly made me a better doctor because I can talk to my patients, not using my own example, but at least we're truly understanding what it's all about.
You also lost your mother, and she was significantly older when you lost her to multiple sclerosis.
Right.
And that was, I sense, a more difficult loss in some ways because the illness was more difficult to understand, or what made that a more difficult process?
First, she was chronically ill. She had polio in the 50s and then went on to have a lot of symptoms that I'm certain were MS, but we didn't have CAT scans and sophisticated methods for making the diagnosis. And so for a long time, she would just fall down at unexpected times and having various strange symptoms. Eventually, she was diagnosed. She was actually relieved to get a diagnosis, surprisingly. Hooray, I have MS. But at least she felt that there'd been a name given to it, and so she didn't feel like she was a kook. But the problem with MS and a lot of those illnesses is they go on to some degree of dementia, lots of instability, risk of falls, having to go through the process where when you drive down to visit your mother in a nursing home, you know she's not going to ask anything about your children. She's not going to ask you about how your career's going, and that you're going to try to carry on a one-sided conversation, make it as meaningful as you can, talk a lot to the nursing home staff, and leave pretty certainly very depleted. And so, that whole process of dealing with a parent who from the time you're born has had polio. She got right. Polio when I was 2 years old, and then following through that long history of debilitating illness.
From your personal experience with your parents and as a practitioner of palliative care, how does that inform the decisions that you think you'll make at the end of your life?
Even though I see death every day, some days 3 people dying, sometimes 10 people in a week, I think I'll make courageous decisions. I'm not sure. I really love life. I've spent my career trying to preserve life. I can say that by working with the dying patients and struggling with my own spirituality, sorting out issues of prayer and faith and higher powers and all combinations of that, and respecting patients who come from very, very diverse backgrounds and faiths, I'm confident, just as I tell my patients, that although I'm going to have a struggle of some sort, when I become aware that my death is close, I can say that the patients do the dying beautifully. the vast majority of the time. They figure it out. They get over their fear. They get their symptoms relieved, hopefully. They're lovingly cared for. And something happens to us when we get that place to that place, and death works its way through. And so I'm confident that that's going to be the case.
We're all going to face this in one way or another. Obviously, we all are mortal, but we also have to deal with this with our parents, with our brothers and sisters, with our children sometimes, with our spouses. And in our society, there is a culture where we believe we should do everything we can to save a person. Do you think that's something that we as a whole culture need to rethink, to understand that there's a time to say enough is enough?
We desperately have to move back to that. The question is, where do we start to reintroduce that? I don't want to, you know, if I say the phrase having a culture of caring certainly doesn't imply that the people who are treating you aggressively to save your life are not caring people. They absolutely are. But it also shouldn't be a situation that we've run out of things to do to you, you know, now figure out how to get your dying done. What a terrible, insensitive situation. So how the majority of our patients we expect are going to do well. What we have to do is recognize when the patient is showing signs of failing. That's the time to start to have this kind of conversation, to help figure out the decisions they want to have made and to help prepare them for that so they can make informed decisions and make good decisions for themselves.
Are these conversations we should have with our loved ones when we're healthy?
We should. There's not enough urgency or focus, I think, to pull it off. But ideally, we would have these discussions very early. How do we want to be cared for? It's a great gift to your children or family members to let them know where they should generally draw the line, because no one wants to, at a critical time, make a decision that is a vote against someone in the eyes of God. If they can instead try to conjure up a voice that's an imitation of what their father would have said, say it once, get it over with, and then go back to their grieving, that would be the best way they could do it.
Dr. Thompson, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Dr. Tim Thompson is Interim Director of Palliative Care at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. This is Talk of Iowa. This hour, we're talking about end-of-life care, and now we'll focus on hospice care. With me is Beth Brower. She is a medical social worker at the residential hospice facility Kavanaugh House, part of Hospice of Central Iowa. Hello, Beth.
Hi, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
I'm happy to be here.
Renee Wellhausen is also with us. She's an RN who works with Hospice of North Iowa in Mason City. Hello, Renee.
Hello, Charity.
Thank you for being here today. And hospice care and palliative care have a great deal in common. Palliative care physicians and nurses often work in conjunction with hospice in many cases. Beth, from my perspective, the most significant difference is really timing, that palliative care can be offered at any time, but hospice care comes with a time limit, right?
Right. It's the end of people's lives.
What qualifies someone for hospice care?
Two physicians have to sign that they have less than 6 months to live. So their primary care physician and our medical director.
And, of course, as I was just talking with Dr. Thompson, he's in a position where he has to often be the one to tell someone that their life is coming to an end. By the time they come to you, they already know that.
They do know that. And then we get to say, you know this is happening and how this is how we can help you.
How would you characterize the work that you do?
I think the most important thing that I do as a social worker is to be the emotional support person. And hospice is person-centered care versus patient-centered care. So our unit of care is the patient and the family. And so a lot of my time is spent with the families. One of the big things that we do is do an initial assessment where I look for things like their family dynamics. What other things do they need my help with? Have they done advanced directives? Do they need other resources? Have they done funeral planning and just the types of things that I can help them with?
Renee, as a hospice nurse, what would you add to that?
You know, as far as the nurses, we do a lot with symptom management, controlling these patients' symptoms. We're also there for emotional support, and we're key into providing education to these patients and families on things that they might experience, things that are normal. Just if you keep these families educated, it's not as fearful of a process as what it could be if they weren't educated.
And Renee, you have said that for a long time you believed that hospice nurse was the one job you wouldn't do. Why did you feel that way?
Well, when I was a young nursing student, I had to follow the hospice nurse around that day, and I just didn't understand at that point in time, at that point in my life, why anybody would choose to do that job. But as you get older and events happen in your life, things change.
Was there an event that changed your mind?
You know, there's probably a lot of events that changed my mind. I had my own kids, and my goal was to be an OB nurse, but then I had a child that had colic, and that at that point in time was not something I wanted to do, and hospice just kind of fell into my lap, I guess I would say, and it was something that I found that I liked doing after I got to do it more often. But it was not a goal of mine, that's for sure.
Beth, working in a hospice facility, a hospice house, how much time do people normally spend in your care?
I think that varies so much, it'd be hard to say, but it can be less than 24 hours, and we've actually had people that have been there over a year.
Wow.
So,
what a lot of us think about hospice, and Renee will talk about this with you because I know you provide hospice care in people's homes, and that's kind of the traditional model that most of us think about when we think about hospice. Beth, what does a hospice house have to offer to people?
Well, one of the things that I think we offer best is that the caregiver doesn't have to provide the care. They can just be the family member and be present with their loved one, knowing that their time is going to be very short.
Does it also provide some kind of stress relief to not have to keep a home ready for people to visit and think
yes,
about those things?
I'd say very much, because when people talk about going home, you know, we know when somebody's as ill as they are, when we see them, it's really 24/7. It's really three people, 8 hours a day at minimum. And a lot of times it's maybe an elderly spouse who can no longer lift or give the physical care.
Now, I think that, again, for a lot of people, they think that it's either hospice at home or care in a hospital at the end of life.
Mm-hmm.
What would you see as the difference between a hospice facility and a hospital?
I think it's really that the patient drives the care. So we don't come in and turn on lights and have a set schedule. You know, when they wake up, if they want to eat, there's food anytime, 24/7. You know, we ask them if they want something, but it's really comfort driven. So it's up to them if they want to eat or drink. And, you know, we try not to do any invasive, like poking with needles. And, you know, it's really about managing their symptoms in the most comfortable way possible.
Why do you think people tend to come to your facility? What are some of the reasons that you hear from families?
Oh, that's a good question. You know, most people are served in their homes or in a nursing facility. And I think we tend to probably see more people that come from a hospital setting or that they just weren't able to give the care anymore at home. And I think those two things, they probably look at their family member and say, I can't do this at home. So they would then come to us.
When someone comes into the facility, how do you start? What's the first thing you do with them?
Well, I think we try to put them at ease, give a tour, show them, you know, this is where you're going to be, just make it as comfortable as possible. And then I usually work in team with my nurse practitioner, and we sit down with either the patient and the family or the family separately. while the nurse is doing their assessment, and we talk to them and just find out who is this person. And then we also talk about the disease process and what do they know. And a lot of times people, I don't like to use the word denial, but they're not going to, you know, they're hopeful, but realistic. And one of the questions that she'll always ask is, how sick do you think this person is? And that just helps them face reality. And many times there are a lot of tears because they have to acknowledge, I think they're pretty sick.
Do you talk about goals for the final weeks or months of a person's life?
Absolutely. That's something that we would always assess for. And, you know, it's kind of interesting because you think, well, what would my goals be? But people will say, I want to be comfortable. I don't want to have pain. And I think those are things that we do best is symptom management.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. This hour, we're talking about end-of-life care on Talk of Iowa. And I'm talking with Beth Brower, a medical social worker at the residential hospice facility Kavanaugh House, part of Hospice of Central Iowa. Renee Wellhausen is a registered nurse who works with Hospice of North Iowa. She lives in Mason City, and we'll continue our conversation in a moment. We also want to hear from you. What have your experiences been with hospice in your family? What did it mean to you? And have you had that end-of-life discussion with your family members? Do people in your family know what you want? This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about end-of-life health care. We've talked about palliative care, and we're talking now about hospice care. If you'd like to join our conversation, give us a call at 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. If you've been through an experience with hospice care, let us know why your family chose to go with hospice and what it meant to you and your loved ones. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. We've also been talking about conversations about what you want at the end of your life or what your loved ones want at the end of their lives. Have you had those conversations in your family? How did it go? Give us a call, 866-780-9100. With me is Beth Brower, a medical social worker at the residential hospice facility Kavanaugh House, part of Hospice of Central Iowa. Renee Wellhausen is also here. She's a registered nurse who works with Hospice of North Iowa. And Renee, obviously as a nurse, you are involved in the medical care part of a hospice. But when you get a new patient, how do you get started?
The first thing is making sure that they understand what is going on, because I have had some cases where we're just kind of getting sent out to talk to families about what hospice care is. And sometimes they are kind of surprised with their diagnosis. I think there's some providers out there that just aren't comfortable having that conversation with them. So sometimes that's always a kind of a touchy conversation to have with them.
So they can already be engaged in hospice care and not actually know their diagnosis?
It's not engaged in hospice care. It's coming out there to talk to them about what hospice care is. They're not signed up for hospice. You're giving them information on what hospice is.
Okay. I'm sure that can be a very difficult conversation to have.
That is a very difficult conversation to have. That's why it's always very nice that we work together as a team for hospice. You know, we're not just one person providing that care. We have a team of people that do that.
At this point in a person's life, obviously the time they have left is limited. You're there to help them be comfortable and make sure that they have the best care possible. But you also become a part of this person's life. And often I know that very strong bonds are formed. How do you see your role as a friend and a part of this family dynamic?
You know, you do become a strong patient advocate and a strong, even the family's advocate. But there is boundaries you have to keep, because if you cross those boundaries, you wouldn't last in hospice for very long.
You would have your heart broken too many times.
Yes. You have to keep those professional boundaries.
Beth, we were talking about end of life goals, before the break. Are there some unusual things that you've been able to help patients accomplish in their final weeks?
I think we're very fortunate because our foundation is able to help us with quality of life funds to grant wishes. And probably the most recent one I did was for a single mom whose family lived out of state, and she was cut off from her son. So we made the contact with him, and he was willing to come and talk to her. And so he and his wife and his daughter came, and they were able to take family pictures and really bond and really kind of get through some things that had been left unsaid. And then the neatest thing about it was the day that he left, one of her friends just said, I was driving by and I felt like I should come to see her, because we were really worried when he left what her emotional state was going to be. And so the friend was there to kind of transition her and help her talk about it and process through some things. And, you know, I said things like that when they happen are not a coincidence. But I think last year HCI granted 80-some wishes to patients and families all over the area that we serve.
Wow.
Yeah.
Are you often in a position where you're helping to facilitate communication between a family and a patient?
Very often. One of the things that we do is set up family meetings, and it might be with the patient present. Or it may not be, where we just talk about, you know, these are the things that we want to address, and then we'll go to the patient. You know, everybody's family has family dynamics, and I was a bereavement counselor for HCI previous to this job, and, you know, I worked in a nursing home, and I just feel like in social work overall, you see, like, what is normal in families. And in my experience, normal is somebody has substance use issues, somebody has mental health issues, and somebody is cut off. And just telling people that, I think it really helps them to see, like, okay, either we're all normal or nobody's normal, but everybody goes through things.
Are there things that you find patients in your care are willing to talk to you about that they can't talk to their family members about?
Well, one conversation I always try to have is to say to them, are you afraid? And I feel like that's something families are probably not going to go there with. And people will say, oh, I'm not afraid of dying. And I say, well, if you were, let me just tell you what other people have told me. And I will talk to them about people are afraid of how they're going to die and when they're going to die. And I say, we can't really do anything about the when, because that's between you and God. And even though we can look at patterns and things that happen over time, over many different people, the nurses can say, you know, I think you have days or weeks or months or sometimes hours. But what I can talk about is the how. And I'd say, you know, what we typically see is that people are very comfortable, and that's something that we can help with, is that you're not going to die in pain. You're going to be very comfortable, and we can talk about who do you want in the room, what kinds of things do you want, like do you want music playing, just anything that would help them be comfortable.
Let's go to the phones now. A lot of people want to share their experiences. Susan is on the line in Cedar Rapids. Hello, Susan.
Hi.
Hi. What would you like to share?
Well, my grandmother was at the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice in Hiawatha, and it was the most wonderful experience for my whole family. At one point, we had like 30 people from all over the country come to visit her, and, you know, in and out of the room and in the waiting area and the kids' area, and that never could have happened in a hospital setting. But I got to sit with my grandmother through the last hours and hold her hand, and it was a wonderful experience. It's just, they made the hospice care staff just made everything as comfortable for her. And I mean, it was a circle of life kind of thing, because she had her great-great-grandbaby there too. So, I mean, it was just a wonderful experience.
Well, Susan, thank you so much for sharing that. And I'm sure that there are some moments like that where an entire family can gather. There are probably other times when there aren't a lot of people present. Beth, what do you see people, do you see patients actually able to say what they want at that moment?
I think so. You know, we have family rooms and a family kitchen area, and people often spend the night. And we have a walking path outside and places for people to sit. And one thing that's happened recently is people sit outside, and that's kind of their bonding area. And they've placed notes. We have a little rock garden, and they've been placing notes under the rocks. And we do have a ritual at the end of life where people can write in a book and then come back 10 years later and look at that book. But that is new, that they put the notes under the rocks.
Huh. Interesting. Let's go to Mary in Iowa City now. And Mary, I understand you had a very different kind of experience. What was your experience?
My husband was dying, and he knew it. But the hospice, he was signed up with hospice, but they were not effective at all, absolutely not effective. In fact, when he passed, there was no one at the house with me. Hospice didn't come. Ministers didn't come. I don't know why. There was no one around to explain to the grandchildren, and they've had a hard time with the loss, as to what was going on.
Wow.
You know, when you're younger, you know, like between 6 and 15, it's at a complete loss. Now, myself, I know I'm just not exactly sure if I want hospice.
Well, Mary, that sounds like an extraordinarily difficult experience. I'm so sorry that you had to go through that.
You know, when you constantly hear the doctor saying, well, you're terminal, there's nothing we can do, that's a rough road.
Yeah.
And it's a rough statement to understand. I'm not afraid of dying when the time comes, that you know. Right now, I don't feel it, but I never know when that time would be. But you just, when you hear that word, it's terminal. Well, you know, there's no sense really doing much more because you're terminal. I think that is the roughest statement a physician can say.
Mary.
I even in today's medicine, I don't feel that the doctors listen to what the patient is saying.
Mary.
And it's not until you get very upset and you say, you're not listening, then they become very defensive. What do you mean? I'm not listening.
Mary, thank you so much for sharing your experience, and that sounds like a very painful experience to go through. Beth and Renee, I know that in a normal situation, a large part of hospice care is supposed to be listening. I mean, Renee, is that something important that you, even as a nurse, are trained to do?
It is, and it's something that's very crucial to hospice patients and their families. Just so you know what is going on with these patients and families. It's a very important part of the job, even for the social workers and all of our other team members.
And Mary's situation, obviously you can't speak specifically to what happened there, but when somebody is receiving in-home care with hospice, what is usually the goal as far as that care and being there when the time comes?
You know, I can't say that we can be there for every person's death. And, you know, hopefully these families will call us if something is, because, you know, we're not very good mind readers. So hopefully they did contact their hospice to let them know that the patient had made a change in status and, you know, kind of asked for somebody to come out. Because most certainly we would have came out if they were asked to come out. But that had to be a hard thing for that family to go through. And I think that's what's crucial about getting hospice in so early, is so we can start these conversations early and start this education early on what's normal and on what to expect, and that the social workers can maybe get in there and visit with these children to kind of let them know what's kind of normal and prepare them as well. Because that would be very hard on a family.
Yeah, definitely. Do you feel like people come to hospice in time? I mean, we talked earlier in the hour about how, yes, of course, we always want to hope that a person can get better, and we have a hard time admitting that they can't or coming to terms with that. Do you feel that people often come to hospice too late?
I do, especially when you look at our, we have lengths of stay, and, you know, our lengths of stay with patients typically isn't very long, and some of that is patient-driven. You know, they want to try all they can. But really, for a hospice to be the most effective, the earlier they can get us involved, the better for that patient and family. Because there's a lot of rapport that needs to be built for those patients to have trust in you.
Beth, what is your take on that? Do you feel that many people come too late?
I absolutely agree with Renee on that people could access it much sooner than they do, and they could be helped much sooner than they are. And like she said, it is hard to build that trust and even to educate them about the services, because I do feel really bad that Mary didn't get the support that she needed. But we do have bereavement counselors, and that's mandated that hospice programs have bereavement counselors that follow the patient and family, the patient's family, for 13 months after the death. So she could probably still call that hospice and get some counseling.
Let's go back to the phones. Ruth is on the line in Ames. Hello, Ruth.
Hi.
Hi. What would you like to talk about?
Well, actually, my mother just passed away in 2012, and at the time, all of my siblings and I were kind of in our 20s, and so we were still kind of new to the idea of, like, losing, you know, a parent to some degree, and I think it was extensively more difficult because we were younger and unfortunately hadn't maybe had a whole lot of death kind of occurring. Our grandparents had passed away before we were born, and so we hadn't really had to deal with that sort of a situation. And I'm just curious, I guess, Beth and Renee, how much outreach or I feel to some extent like there's a lot of taboo around talking about death. Like, people are sort of afraid to, you know, have a conversation about it. And so then when it is happening, it's very overwhelming. And so I don't know if you've experienced, you know, sort of that with trying to, you know, get people educated about hospice and other programs that are available to kind of help people, you know, when they are going through sort of the process. So I don't know if that's something either one of you have experienced at all, you know, in your field, or it's just overall you get the feeling that, you know, there's some taboo still that exists around the idea of, you know, the process of dying.
Right. Ruth, thank you so much for your call. And this is a very difficult conversation for families to have, for individuals to have, and obviously things happen at unexpected times. Beth, do you have advice for people on how to broach this subject or any resources for them?
Well, I think Ruth is absolutely right. When you're in your 20s, your friends have not experienced that, so you really don't have people that you can go to for support. We do grief support groups, and you can access that on the website, hcicareservices.org. And I think other hospices have grief support groups, so whatever area you live in, look for a grief support group. And I also think counseling, you know, counselors would be able to help you with grief counseling.
How about proactive end-of-life conversations and decisions? Do you know of any resources to help? I'm sure they're out there.
Yes. Well, one thing that I do assess for is when we have young family members, we have a booklet that we give people that talks about developmental stages and what kids understand. And it really, like, I'll talk to children, but I think families mostly want to talk to them themselves, but it gives them some points to talk about. And it's just important to have somebody that you can go to talk. So if, you know, and we're, hospices are community resources, so they could call HCI and the bereavement counselor could speak to them.
All right. Beth, thank you so much for your time today. Beth Brower of Cavanaugh House, part of Hospice of Central Iowa, and Renee Wellhausen, thank you to you, a registered nurse who works with Hospice of North Iowa. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.